All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to episode 4 of the Beer Pinions podcast. My name is Pat Berger, and as always, I have Bruce Chris White with me. How you doing, Bruce?
Doing well. Beautiful fall day. Nice, crisp here in Chicago. Good beer drinking weather.
It is. In the midst of a Cub race to the World Series.
Yep. You're pumped about that, aren't you, Pat?
I'm joining the Cub bandwagon. I'm cheering for the Cubs.
We got
it. It's official. Not with too much passion or effort, but I am happy for my Cub-loving friends. And I have many of them, so go Cubs. There, I said it. And with us, a major Cub fan and a all-around, let's say, beer historian or Chicago historian looking at history through the lens of alcohol. Is that?
That sums it up.
Liz Garraby is with us, a good friend and just all-around great person who always has something enlightening. Every time I see her, I learn something new. So I'm very excited for this podcast.
Thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate it. I want to say that if my crush on Pat Berger wasn't already big enough, now that he just said go Cubs, I might cry a little.
All right. Unlike the Doug Stone podcast, we won't talk about baseball the whole time.
Yeah, right.
We will get on to the dealings of beer. And speaking of the dealings of beer, Liz, thanks to the wonders of Facebook, I saw that you had a pretty beery trip recently in Europe. You want to break it down where you've been?
Yeah, I had a very brief stint in France, spent some time in northern Spain, Austria, Germany, Italy, and a quick little layover in England.
Awesome. Were you leading a tour? It kind of seemed like you were
in
charge.
Yeah, so with my company, History on Tap, I started out doing a lot of local Chicago tours and talks and then went national and then international to do talks and then tours. So this was the second one I've ever done. Last year was Scotland, and this year was a journey through Austria, learning about history and culture through beer mostly, some wine, some schnapps.
I like the schnapps.
Yeah. And then fortunate enough to end in Munich for Oktoberfest. So I had 13 people with me, and it was great.
Is that your first Oktoberfest?
It was my second, thankfully.
Yeah.
I was prepared. It's unreal. Yeah. You know, it's like something I've ever seen before. You can go to, you know, the wonderful event known, you know, as Lincoln Square Oktoberfest or Mayfest, or, you know, go to any place around the world to, you know, some sort of festival. But that is just hands down just, you know, a lone wolf, really.
It is. I always liken it to, like, Six Flags for beer lovers. And, you know.
Totally.
I happened to be there on my honeymoon many, many moons ago.
Oh, man. Oh.
And I acted like one of our children when we tried to leave Six Flags. My wife was like, come on, it's time to go. No, babe, one more liter. I just want one more liter. She had to drag me by the arm, you know, like we do our kids from the rides. It was, I had a very good time.
The first time I went, and I was shocked to see rides because you don't really know.
Yeah.
You see all these, like, you know, merry-go-rounds and carnival rides and, like, stuff you would see at Six Flags. And then I'm thinking, how the hell would anyone get on those things after they've been drinking?
Yeah, like 6 liters and then, liters and then on a roller coaster.
Yeah, no thanks.
How many people a day? I haven't been. I got to go. Oh, my God, I'm embarrassed. But how many people a day? Isn't it like... So tens of thousands of people a day that go to
this thing,
right? Well,
let's see. There are 16 tents, and each fit between, 3,000 and 6,000, and there's 2 sessions.
Okay. Oh, man.
So.
Yeah, I didn't know there was going to be math today.
Yeah. Over 16 days. I don't know.
There's a lot.
There's a shit ton of beer drinkers.
Yeah.
And people, you know, what amazes me is everyone is shit tank drunk. I mean, people are not pretending to be sober. But you don't see a fight. I didn't see a fight there. And it is people of all nationalities and, you know, everyone's just having a good time over beer.
Yeah, the neat thing, too, is that it's really also a lot of locals that embrace it. And everyone is very much into wearing the traditional costume.
Like passionate about representing.
Absolutely.
Like
So you see the dirndls, you see the lederhosen, you see the lady hosen. And everyone who came on the trip, they, like, a couple of days, we were in Austria, and in Munich, and so a couple of days before, everyone just went shopping. Like, they were focused on making sure they had traditional dress on at Oktoberfest, because I kept emphasizing it.
Yeah, I was cracking up, because, like, even, like, the department stores there are selling drindles and the lederhosen. You know, I made an observation while I was there. As fantastic as women look in a drindle, I mean, they really, it's one of my favorite outfits on the female form. And as great as it looks, that's how equally stupid men look in lederhosen. Agree? Disagree?
I think it's all...
Suede shorts?
That's hot, actually.
Yeah?
I had to get myself a pair of the lady shorts.
Okay.
And they were, very comfortable. I was very happy. Like, I want to wear them around, like, Chicago, if I can. Maybe, like, walk the dogs in them or something.
Well,
I don't know.
We have our own Oktoberfest. I'm sure you can.
I know. I want to. And we, you know, in the United States, we traditionally, like, push Oktoberfest all the way through October. So that's a bonus. So I'm thinking I can get away with it.
It's true.
But I will say that there are a lot of buttons on that thing. And it's, you know, leather and suede, which is really hard to get the buttons, like, through the holes.
Oh, yeah.
So going to the bathroom for the first couple times was really aggravating. And really scary.
Yeah, I don't even like to wear a button fly jeans when I go out drinking, much less a buttoned up suede outfit.
Is that why so many guys wear sweatpants everywhere?
Well, that's because we've just given up on life.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, I bet lederhosen look fine on, like, guys who work out all the time. But, you know, like, guys who drink beer, like, I'm not going to speak for you, Pat, but unfortunately, that's
I'm not cutting the lederhosen figure by any means, so. Yeah, I saw a picture of Arnold and his, what do we call it? His love child bonding at Oktoberfest.
Oh, really?
Yes, yeah, so they're both wearing the lederhosen. Arnold does look pretty good in it.
Yeah, Schwarzenegger?
Yeah.
He can pull it off.
So, get in the chopper with your lederhosen.
So, did you have, like, any, outside of the Oktoberfest, were there any, like, beer discoveries you made along the way or anything that, like, struck, you know, just kind of, like, was interesting to you when you were kind of making your journey through Europe on your trip?
You know, it's always just interesting to being involved and being so welcomed by the beer community here in Chicago and the States. You know, you learn things and you experience different things and you think you know what to expect. And it's always, I think the one thing I always appreciate is traveling to any city, any country, and always just experiencing something you never have ever experienced before, whether it's a taste of something or how a process works or really the story behind it. So, you know, it was my first time in northern Spain and first time I ever went to San Sebastian and, you know, learning all about their cider and the process and how you're supposed to drink it. You know, it's always eye-opening. So I think just traveling in general is always such a worthy experience for so many reasons, not just if you're in beer, of course, or alcohol.
Yeah.
But I think that just meeting people and learning from them and listening to them is just eye-opening always, no matter when it is, where it is.
Yeah,
I mean, the history over there is just so much deeper and longer, too. You know, you visit these breweries that are 200, 300, 400, 500 years old.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we sit here going, Revolution's been around for 8 years now. It's a pretty old brewery.
Pioneers.
OGs on the scene.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure you get some Europeans on your tours. Like, whenever we get Europeans, I'm always like, welcome to the Berghof, you know? Yeah. And I'm like, this is one of the oldest places. And they're like, come on, man, you know?
I try to make fun of it, I start out making fun of a lot of things, but then, you know, try to add some depth to it and appreciate it. But, yeah, like, you know, we did a really fantastic sort of unique VIP thing at Stiegel in Salzburg. And, it's like you start talking about, you know, when they were established in 1492. And you're like, wow.
Columbus sailed the
ocean. They were 2 years or 2 months older than that anniversary.
That's crazy.
And then it doesn't compute, right?
It doesn't, it's hard to put it in perspective.
Right,
yeah,
so, I mean, it's stuff like that when you see just the amount of history that comes through. It's like, gosh, if I actually had to do a lot of work in Europe, my brain would explode because at least with Chicago, I'm dealing with like 1800s,
right,
you know? I got 250, 300 years I got to deal with most of the time.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Europe is another sort of animal.
Talking of Stiegl, did you enjoy the unfiltered Paracelsus?
Oh my God.
Did you get some of that?
I drank everything I possibly could drink there. Yes, I did.
I first had the Stiegl. If you get a chance, what they? How often? It comes over like what? Once or twice a year?
Once or twice. Yeah, basically once now. We tried twice. And
We get the unfiltered version?
Yes, Glenn's brings it over about once a year. They brought it over twice a couple years ago, and the second batch didn't sell as quickly, and it has an incredibly short shelf life.
Yeah.
So literally, by the time it gets to us, it's about 30 days of me pouring it before I can taste the difference, and I stop ordering it.
What time of year does that happen?
Summer.
Oh, okay.
It's summer.
Yeah, I always kind of like, if you get a chance, try the Paracelsus from Stiegl. Yeah. It's what is it, unfiltered Zwickel? Is that what it is?
Exactly. A Zwickel beer refers to the little tap on a fermentation tank is called a Zwickel. And so it's a beer that traditionally you would only get while taking the tour of a brewery in Germany or Austria. And it's before it's processed, before it goes through the filter, before it's packaged. So it's unpasteurized, unfiltered, and in the case of Paracelsus, it is also organic, which is unusual.
Yeah.
And it's all made on a very small, like 7-hectare system that is in their little brew pub.
Yeah,
and
that's
we're very lucky to get it here in Chicago. It's only because Klunz is the importer of Stiegl.
And I learned that they are the number one importer for the whole country.
Huh.
Yes.
Stiegl likes them.
They do, very much, yeah.
And yeah, man, that Paracelsus, I'm a nerd out, but Game of Thrones fans, if I was in Game of Thrones, I feel like I'd have a mug of the Paracelsus. Like, that would be what they would be drinking back in the day, even though Game of Thrones is fiction. And
right, probably didn't taste as good as Paracelsus. Probably, their beer was probably sour and infected.
Right,
Paracelsus
right.
is so the opposite good. Of that.
Cool.
Named for Dr. Paracelsus, who was an advocate of beer as a health remedy.
Yeah, medicine.
Medicine.
Love them already.
Yep.
Well,
yeah.
I agree, based on my extensive medical background.
I take six a day and keeps the doctor
That's it?
Calling me an alcoholic.
did you have a favorite, outside of the booze, like, was there a favorite portion of the trip in terms of, like, a history story that, like, struck to you? I'm sure that's a hard question, right? Because there's so much there. But, like...
That's a tough question because, like I said, each location just has such a difference, in what they've done and where they're at and where they're going, really. You know, one thing I noticed in terms of, like, the history of it all is that everyone is incredibly proud of it, right? Everyone embraces their own sort of story, in a sense, and they carry on that tradition.
Yeah.
And one thing that I think we all know is that traditional places like Germany, right? You see traditional lagers or pils or German styles, but slowly you're starting to see how the United States is influencing, styles or what kind of beer they're making. And you see it more than you have in the past, right? Whereas I noticed that when I was in Spain, it's just starting, right? So that was just an interesting sort of look at past and present.
Stone, has their brewery that's opened very recently in Berlin. And I got to hear Greg Cook do a question and answer about it. And, he's a confident man. He's pretty confident that they will endear themselves to the German market. But, my question to him was like, look, man, I've heard, I've been in Germany a few times. I've talked to a lot of Germans about beer. And they have such contempt for non-German beer, like, how do you tackle that obstacle? They are so entrenched.
Rheinhausgebot, right?
Like, not only that, but just if it's not German, it's crap to them, It's like, they don't see any reason to drink non-German beer.
Sure.
So we'll see how that plays out. I think he's in a good position being the first one going in there, and there is interest in places like Berlin for anything American and anything cutting edge. So.
Yeah, I mean, I think of all places, Berlin might be the right place to do it just because it's a little bit, more progressive in a way. It's in the north versus, the Bavarian, the purity laws you must mention, which this year I chose Austria and Oktoberfest this year because it was the 500th anniversary of the purity law. And so seeing, I wanted to see like if everyone, they're going to go crazier, you know, what was going to go down. But
and for my dad out there, by the way, hi dad, the German purity law basically means you can only brew beer with four things: water, malt, barley, hops, and yeast. Although originally I believe it was only three because they didn't really know what yeast was.
Right.
So they added that on once they figured that out.
Yep.
So just wanted to lay it out for pops.
Ryan High School.
Yeah. Interesting. I'm curious to see how that goes.
Yeah, we'll see. There is some news that Bruce flashed to me before we started this podcast that Stone has cut 5% of their workforce. You know, maybe a sign that we are seeing a slowdown here in craft beer and certainly in the expansion of some of these larger breweries. Is the bubble bursting?
Yeah.
I think.
Interesting.
I think there's certainly a slowdown happening, and these foreign markets are a prime territory for these breweries. You know, they're all getting pretty fed up with fighting over my tap handles, you know. there's some untapped market overseas, Mexico, South America, China.
Yeah, for sure.
It's pronounced China. China is huge. It's going to be huge. it's a huge beer market. It's the number one beer market in the world. So, you know, you get your the number one selling beer in the world is a Chinese beer that none of us have ever heard of called Snow.
Really?
I was reading about
it. Outsells every other beer in the world.
What kind is it?
I don't know. Some crappy industrial lager, probably. Yeah. I've never had it. But, you know, it's just some beer. But just because it's the number one beer in China, that makes it the number one beer in the world.
I was reading about, like, an article about Australia flashed before my eyes about how the farmers were being impacted in the downturn of the Chinese beer market. I'm like, that is the most globalization article I've ever read.
Yeah.
Because they're like, supply most of the barley, apparently. But yeah, crazy. That's awesome. So, Liz, I was telling you right before we started the podcast, I actually knew, I've been a fan for a long time. And knew about you and wanted to just kind of lay out some of your background, how you got into this, because I'm sure there are a lot of people who are like, this is so cool that you, that how you got involved in this history through the lens of alcohol.
Yeah.
So now, if I'm not mistaken, you started off with the Chicago History Museum, correct?
Yeah, I was on staff there for 7-8 years or so. My background is actually in anthropology and archaeology.
Oh, me too.
Really? See?
Yes.
See? Yeah, this is why we get along. I found that field to be amazingly rewarding, but also very lonely when you go out to dig, you know, and spend time. So I shifted my focus on urban history, and I've always had a love for Victorian era and 19th century America, sort of the beginnings, right, of our country. And lo and behold, shocker, that my hometown of Chicago is a prime example of everything that that means. So I came back home after graduate school and shifted my focus and started working at the History Museum, really kind of trying to teach people about history in new and dynamic ways. So I started doing a few things there, but prior to that, I had been researching a lot of bar histories. I really just enjoy spending time at bars. Right? I know you guys are really surprised by that.
almost everything I know about Patty Long's history, I learned from you.
Oh, really?
Yeah, from you. Because you would bring the tour in, and I listened in, and I was like, I didn't know any of this.
That's cool.
That's how I got a date for the building, because when we closed, the only date they could give us was pre-1900, because I guess there was a fire in the records or something. But you were able to tell me it was 1895.
Yep.
And you were able to tell me what it was before it was Lowry's, which was 79 years ago now, but it was a butcher shop?
Grocery store, maybe?
Grocery store, and before that, maybe a butcher shop
or
something?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
German area, that makes sense. So I started doing a lot of that, right? Researching, just because I'd go to the bar and I'd talk to a lot of the old guys that had been sitting around. I tend to gravitate toward simple neighborhood bars that, you know, people have been going to always.
That's why I've been seeing you at the Old Town Ale House as well.
Yeah. I spend a lot of time there. In fact, I see Chris there.
Well, my business partner, that is his local.
He
has a painting on the wall, which I believe is similar to a death sentence, maybe? Once you get your painting on the wall of the Old Town Ale House, you have, like, 10 years to live.
Shit, yeah. Really? Mine's been up there for like 3 years.
Oh, 7 years.
Oh, no.
Sorry, Liz. Sorry,
In fact, Chris and I watched the most recent Cubs amazing game together the other night at the Ale House. But anyway, that's a different story.
Bruce, the owner of the Ale House, hates the Cubs.
He hates them, yeah.
He hates the Cub fans.
Yeah, and he can be a real asshole about it, too, which is irritating. But, you know, we all have our faults. So
Bruce an asshole? I don't believe you.
He's actually a really good guy, in a way.
He's one of the good assholes.
He is. Good bar. A barman, if you will.
Bourdain was in that place, right?
Yeah, they're good buddies. Episode. They're good buddies. Yeah.
If you're filmed in there twice.
Yeah, if you're a fan of Anthony Bourdain, he was at the Old Town Ale House in his last Parts Unknown episode in Chicago. A huge fan of Bourdain. Love that guy. Cool. All right.
Yeah. Yeah, he loves that place. But anyway, so I spent a lot of time at these bars and listening to a lot of the old guys talk about stories, right, of bars, the neighborhood, and real curious about it. But at the same time, you're like, all right, how much of this is fact and how much of it is fiction? Because you've been sitting here for 40 years drinking.
Filtered through endless pints of beer.
Yeah. So that really kind of got me thinking about, trying to sort what was real and not. And eventually I'd start doing a lot of research, finding out dates, finding out different stories, verifying other stories. And then, talking to current owners or folks that work there and get some more modern era stories. And eventually just kind of have the, overall history or picture of one particular bar. You do nearby ones, and next thing you know, you have the history of a neighborhood, the history of a city, right? And so I started doing that. And when I started working at the History Museum, I realized that I had about 100 or so bar histories in my back pocket when I started working there. So I proposed the idea to start something called History Pub Crawls, where I would just take people out, go to 4 bars, drink, talk history, and really kind of experience it. And so they let me do it on a very tight leash, because, the concept of taking people out to drink, from the perspective of a museum, a cultural institution, was a little bit rare in 2007 when I started them. But lo and behold, they're big hits, right? And anything selling out at a history museum at that time was sort of never happening. So the fact that we were there really sort of changed. It was a game changer. So continued that on for my tenure there, and then I started getting a lot more requests to do things for different organizations or consult. Sometimes breweries would approach me and say, hey, we want to learn more about this era or this event in history because we want to do something with a beer, or have another organization say, hey, we want to infuse some fun and alcohol into what we're doing. So I would have to really kind of just say no to a lot of things, and I got tired of saying no. So eventually I just left the museum and started exploring a lot of things that I wanted to do on my own. And that just grew and grew and grew. And so, now it's a lot about giving talks and tours. And I'm fortunate to have a great support in my hometown here in Chicago, the Midwest, the country, and now internationally.
That's awesome. That's great.
You ever thought of writing like a coffee table book?
Yeah.
I would buy it.
Thanks. Actually, it's definitely a project that's been in the works for a little while. So that will hopefully be something that is produced sooner than later.
Hot scoop here on Beer Opinions.
Yeah.
we got the
there's
scoop.
There's actually a publisher out there already, so it's a matter of what story we really want to tell.
Awesome. And that will segue us into the next topic, which is going to be your Brewseum project.
Mm.
But first, we are going to take a short break because we have to change some batteries. We'll be right back. All right, we're back, full battery power now, ready to go. We are here with Liz Garraby, brew historian and owner of, what is the name of the company, Liz, that you own?
History on Tap.
History on Tap.
And where can we find you online?
Historyontap.com.
All right.
Now we're going to talk about a pet project of yours that is really very exciting. I went to the launch. Event for it, and it's very exciting. It's called the Chicago Brewseum.
obviously, from the name, you can tell it is a brewery museum.
Yeah.
That you want to bring to Chicago, one of the great brewing cities in the country now. Why don't you give us a little background on that and the story?
Well, it all kind of stemmed from my wanting to create an exhibition on Chicago beer history, you know, with all the research I had done and all the tours and, you know, everything, all the information that I sort of accumulated over the several years that I was at the History Museum. I was really trying to push for a beer history exhibition, and timing was never right. It just wasn't going to work. And so when I left the museum, this idea of the exhibition was always sort of, you know, bouncing around in my head. And so one day, as I was sort of sketching out what that exhibition would be, which I actually did on a regular basis, I realized just how much more I would keep adding each time, right, to the piece of paper. And then one day I said, you know what? This needs a whole, like, brick and mortar.
Needs a home, yeah.
Yeah. And so I started thinking about it and thinking, well, it's a big project. Okay, I don't even know where to begin. So I'm fortunate enough to serve on some boards that involve sort of Chicago philanthropists, right? People that give money to projects. And I had several meetings with them and just said, hey, here's my idea. Here's what it would look like. And I was surprised, really, and excited to learn that they all love the project and the concept. And really, my question was, is it fundable? Like, does Chicago need this? And they all said, if you did it, you know, if you did it right, it can happen. So that was great. That was sort of the first step. And then next steps were really building a team, building a board of directors. And I really wanted this to be a national scope. Chicago is a great beer town. I often argue that it's a city built on beer. It's a city that is now continuing to be built on beer. And it's a great example of the overall American story. But I really wanted to tell the American story, in a sense. So I really wanted it to be a national scope. So I wanted to also broaden the team in terms of who was on it, people in different locations around the country. So as I started to build the team, we eventually had our first meeting and then really kind of met for 2 years trying to just figure out, you know, mission, vision, brand, goals, timeline, all the things you need to sort of get it right. And we didn't want to make an announcement until we thought we had it right. So earlier this year, we thought it was time to make an announcement. So we had our launch in May. And the idea is that we will be a museum, four stories, first floor really being a brew pub, in a sense, have a nano brewery, have, you know, Brewseum Brew on draft, have some great collaborations with people all over the world. And really that is the thing that will sustain operations for the museum. We are official 501c3 nonprofit. And then the rest of the floors will be, you know, gallery space. One focus is Chicago, the Chicago story, of course. That's our main gallery. Another gallery will tell the story of a different city. A different gallery will sort of be a crapshoot, you know, like what's happening with hops right now or graphic design and labels. And have event space and then a rooftop beer garden. And the idea is to just, you know, be able to just infuse a lot of history and culture in the beer community. The focus for sure is hands down a museum. We want to be part of the cultural landscape. We want to be a destination, the way people come and go to the Field Museum, the Art Institute, right? We want to be a museum that people want to go to. And then, of course, have a great beer while you're there.
Yeah, I mean, it would be a must stop for people on their beercations, which...
That's right.
You know, that happens.
Yeah.
People come to Chicago and... You know, they have a checklist of all the beer places they have to hit, just like I do when I go anywhere.
Right, right. Yes.
The way to see a city is to drink your way through it.
I mean, that's the first thing I do. When I go to a city, I always either research or I send emails off to people that I know that know those places and say, where do I need to go?
Yeah. I mean, and we've all been to some pretty terrible brewery museums. I have, anyway. I've been to a couple of really nice ones. Guinness has, actually. a pretty fantastic.
Yeah, it's very corporate though, you know.
It is. But it's, you know, it's well done, and the exhibits are nice.
Yeah.
They put a lot of money into it.
Yeah, that's the thing. When I was researching if something like this existed, the amazing thing was that it didn't. So everywhere that had a museum was tied to a brewery, right?
Yeah,
so Guinness.
There's one in Brussels.
That is just a history of beer.
How big is it? It's not great. It's tiny.
Yeah, yeah.
For a nerd like me, there's some cool old equipment in there.
Right.
But it feels like it's hasn't been touched in 30 years, you know.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
It's not impressive, but...
I know where it's...
Right in the Grand Palace.
It's right in the
Grand...
Yeah. Yeah, it's teeny.
Yeah, it's teeny.
It's Kaiser Tiger's like a palace compared to
and
it.
It's like one room with some old equipment in it. I mean, this is what I'm talking about. That's a beer museum. One of the greatest beer cities in the world. And it's pretty pathetic, really.
Yeah.
When this is done, I'm going to say when, because it's awesome.
Thanks.
And I just want Pat Berger to go around the world and be like, it belongs in a museum, whenever he sees something that's beer-related. And then steal it and bring it back.
Yeah.
Well, Indiana Jones was really... really preserving history, you know, while he, like, you know... breaks a skeleton up
that's right.
to then turn it into a torch. I'm going, yeah, that's how archaeology works.
You gotta pick and choose.
Right. I don't think Indiana Jones saw a site he did not destroy.
That's right. That's right. Very true. So I was shocked to see that really didn't exist. I mean, I knew, like, you know, Guinness or even Heineken has something.
Right, but they're all for their brand.
Correct.
Yes.
Correct. So I really want this to be about
an untied house.
Correct. Well,
yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
Having every single brewery involved possible would be amazing.
Yeah.
Right. But this is definitely at our core collaborative. Want this to be part of the beer community. Want it to be part of the cultural community. And just have it kind of be a place where you learn and have a good time.
That's awesome. How far along are you, like, in terms? I know that I believe you're fundraising and you have, like, some online fundraising goals.
So this year was really about raising awareness, letting people know that we exist and we're trying to do this. It's been really kind of a grassroots effort with having a lot of partners, right? So architectural firms offering us, hey, we want to be a part of it. Let's draw for you. Just graphic design folks or whatever it may be, right, to sort of start building it and getting the word out. And then 2017, the goal is to really start raising funds, being aggressive about the capital campaign, whether it's through our CrowdRise account or if it's through events that we want to try to do, a paid endeavor. But really this year has just been about getting out there, doing free events at different places and trying to just raise awareness, build advocacy. And then from there, 2017, we'll hopefully hit the ground running and get aggressive with raising some funds.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I really hope it happens.
Yeah.
If I can be involved in any way that doesn't involve any work whatsoever, totally. I'm volunteering my...
spirit?
My spirit and my... really nothing.
You heard it here.
Well, listen...
No.
As long as
I will always answer the call for you, Liz.
Thank you. Well, as long as we have the Pat Berger seal of approval.
Yeah. Oh, it's stamped and approved.
You know. we've been really just. It's been amazing to see the amount of support around town and actually across the country. Like, I've been getting a lot of emails and calls from people saying this is fantastic, amazing.
Yeah, when I went to that launch, I mean, that was the who's who, man, of brewing, and certainly in Chicago and even out and about. I mean, everyone was at that thing. So, the enthusiasm is definitely there. I think, sometimes that's the hardest step in these things. So you got that. I think we're going to see this happen.
I hope so. But, again, it's really a lot of credit to the team and to the community around here.
Do you, there's a website, is it?
ChicagoBrewsium.org.
Okay, and I imagine you'll have, like, all events and people, you should go check it out, because I'm sure they're going to have some really cool stuff, not only raising money, but also pushing their mission, which is Chicago and history and beer and national history and world history with beer. Great stuff.
Yeah,
so,
it's fun.
Yeah,
maybe a fundraiser in the Skyline Lounge that we're sitting in right now at Kaiser Tiger.
I walked in the door and I already started thinking.
Awesome.
It is here for you. By the way, if you hear a lot of noise on this podcast, I apologize. They're cleaning my ice machine up here. And, you know, I can't send them away. We like clean ice.
This is real life, man.
This is real life. This is a working restaurant.
We're a working podcast.
We're working.
We're not just some pros popping in here. You know, we're collar beer guys.
We're not in a studio. We are in the Skyline Lounge at Kaiser Tiger. What else? I know you've got some other questions.
Well, I was going to ask, so, like, In Search of the Story of Beer.
Yeah.
That was a project you have done, or you had done previously, right?
Yeah, that was last year. You know, in a lot of my research with beer history and beer culture, I was often just sort of interested in how people connect to beer in their own spaces.
Sure.
In their own cities. And then really, when I met John Hall of Goose Island, he's on our board of directors for the Brewseum. I knew his story, but then getting to know him a little bit better and learning more from him and about him and his story, which basically was he was on a plane delay, he loved going to England and drinking ales, and he on his plane delay, he read this magazine article about a brewery in Northern California. And he basically thought, well, I'm going to open a brewery, I think, maybe, because I want to be able to have ales in Chicago.
Was it Sierra, or was it?
No, it was, I don't remember anymore.
Like, yeah, okay, no worries, sorry.
New Albion, maybe?
Maybe, that's it, New Albion, yeah. So he opened the brewery and opened Goose Island, right? And then I just thought, okay, so we got this guy who was so inspired by British ales that he decided to create a brewery, which in 1988, when he opened Goose, you know, was a pioneer. So really spearheaded Chicago's brewing scene, modern brewing scene, but also was one of the very earliest in the country. You know, and then here we are today, 2016, almost 2017, you know, with thousands and thousands of breweries, craft breweries. And that just really kind of got me thinking about the impact of a beer and beer style on just life, right? The world and how you function. So I really kind of wanted to go to Europe and go to some cities that were the places where certain beer styles originated from and talk to people about how they felt about those styles. So I'm a beer person in that I like to drink it and I like to be a part of the community. But I'm certainly not, you know, a brewer. I don't know the ins and outs of, you know, the chemistry, the, you know, microbiology and, you know, all these little things. So I sat down with Ray Daniels, who was the founder of Cicerone, who's also on the Brewseum board, and said, here's my idea, where should I go? So he and I sat with a map, and we discussed it. And I ended up just going to a bunch of different cities and meeting with historians, brewers, bar owners to learn about specific styles of beer in that city or that country and look at how it really affected and influenced culture and identity. And so that was just kind of a fun project that I wanted to do on my own just to educate myself a little bit more. And just because, you know, it's sort of like a geeky thing from a beer drinker's perspective and from a historian perspective and a, you know, beer community perspective.
The history is there. The history is in these stories and what people were drinking and what people were doing, you know. And,
yeah.
Certainly in the, it's true in the bar history that you do as well. I mean, you know, the story of the immigrants coming to Chicago is all in the bar history, right? I mean,
100%.
100%. They all.
That's why I always say is that this city for sure is a city built on beer.
And it's just, I feel like sometimes, like I remember going back to like 10th grade history, you know, world history and falling asleep in class and being like, oh my God.
Yeah, right?
Like this is a little tough, coloring maps of countries, and we did that in 10th grade. I wasn't in advanced history
was
class.
That CPS?
and so, but you know, I think that using kind of a specific thing to look through, to take history and use that as a lens, before, makes it kind of really interesting and maybe a little more nuanced and more easy to digest.
Yeah.
And then the booze, the alcohol, using that is really fun.
Well, that's kind of how it started because, you know, you're a kid and being bored to death, but I'd be sitting around with, you know, 20, 30-year-olds and they were bored to death when we start talking about history. But, you know, magically,
as soon as you bring up,
you bring a beer in front, you have a beer in front of them, and they start getting a little buzz. They're like, oh, well, tell me more about this, right? Yeah. They're actually interested. And I think because alcohol, right, your inhibitions, you know, kind of go away a little bit. With history, you know, you have a lot of facts and figures and names and numbers, and they can be overwhelming and a little bit just too much. So you sort of, you know, I like to say water it down a little bit, and you have a conversation, right? It's about sharing. History, after all, is just stories from the past. So you start sharing it in that way. You start actually using alcohol not only to connect to those stories, but also to just engage you and me, you know, one-on-one. Suddenly, it just becomes all the more appealing, all the more accessible. So that's what I noticed pretty quickly. And
you're using another sense, you know, your right. sense of taste,
yeah.
Right. and smell, and all the rest of it, you know, to go along with learning these, you know, facts and figures and
right.
everything. And it just makes it that much easier. You know, it's just like any study,
right.
or, you know, you write something out, you remember it more.
Yeah.
Well, if you can relate it to a taste and a smell.
True.
You know,
yeah.
Remember that.
You know, and fact of the matter too is that alcohol appeals or is a part of so many people's lives, right? It sort of crosses cultures, it crosses, you know, economics, it crosses all kinds of socio-political, economic boundaries, so we can all relate to it. There's a great bar in Wrigleyville, Higgins Tavern.
Oh, yeah.
Have you been to Higgins?
Yeah, on Racine, just north
yeah,
of
school and
yeah,
yeah, school in Racine, right?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
And I used to live in
Lake... That's where you go to get your Super Bowl square.
I used to go there because it's sort of like the non-Wrigleyville bar, which is what I'm into.
Certainly a neighborhood, old school
neighborhood. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's really kind of like simple. One of the things I noticed right away from spending some time there is that everyone knew everyone, of course, right? But then if you start to, like, peel back the layers a little bit, you got a doctor standing next to a painter, standing next to a plumber, and everyone knows everything about one another's lives, right? And then they start also trading things. Well, I need to get this looked at. Great, come paint my house,
yeah,
and I'll
right.
take care of you. You know, you start, it's such a dynamic environment.
Yeah, it's where people that grew up in Wrigleyville hang out.
Right.
You know, they're not hanging out at Froggy McFuckertons or whatever new...
man, I was just at Froggy McFuckertons.
Nothing against Froggy McFuckertons. I'm sure it's great on game day, but, you know, no one who grew up in that neighborhood hangs out there.
100%.
Right?
Yeah. But, I mean, you know, that bar or that sort of experience, and obviously those bars exist all over the city. It's just, it gives you a really sort of interesting perspective on how everyone is there for the same reason, right? We're there for the bar to drink and be with our bar family.
Right.
And it sort of doesn't matter who you are or your background or how much money you make or your profession. And that just kind of is an interesting sort of idea and way to kind of look at life.
And it's a positive influence, right?
Yeah.
Like, because it allows people to kind of break down those barriers
mm-hmm.
and it allows communities to function more smoothly because
sure.
people know each other.
Yeah.
And people, when you know someone, you're not going to get as mad. You're not going to get as fired up. You're going to talk it through more likely
yeah.
than not.
Right, right. So, you know.
You know, you need it in a varied life. You have your work. You have your family.
Sure.
You have to have your social time.
Yeah.
And if you can pop into a bar for an hour, catch up with your, you know, with your folk at the bar, it fills that, you know, that need.
Yeah, and I mean, that's kind of like why, you know, alcohol makes sense, because we can all connect to it in that way, no matter what kind it is, or when we engage with it, or, you know, how much we consume of it, we all can connect to it. So it was sort of almost like, you know, the minute I started thinking about it, it just became really obvious and really fun. So I have a saying that alcohol is a lubricant for history, because we can all connect to it. And then all of a sudden you start learning about stories or, you know, facts and figures that once upon a time may have been a little bit just too much to deal with. You start learning and you see that moment when people are like, oh
that's
oh,
so cool.
You know,
yeah.
That's when it becomes exciting.
Do you have, and sorry, I know this is a hard question. It's like getting asked your favorite beer. But do you have, is there any story that pops into mind when you know, just something specific? Like, it could be like, and you're more advanced than I am on this, but like 1855 lager beer riots or
yeah.
anything else that like from back in the day and here in Chicago that people might not be aware of that you could share?
Well, hands down, my favorite Chicago beer story is that Chicago was actually born in a bar.
Okay, here we go.
Yeah, so in our charter is 1837, right? But in 1833, we go from village to township, right? So we're a really tiny village, and by 1833, we're growing, and we already have some sort of people making decisions for us. And there were about three bars in 1833 Chicago, and there was already, like, one hot place, right? The happening place to be was a Saugnash Tavern in the Saugnash Hotel.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's the kind of place that if you'd want to go and, like, you know, get a good gambling game in, a good fiddle off. Yeah, you know, that's where you, maybe we should recreate a fiddle off here.
I think we need fiddle off at Patty Lines.
It involves fiddles, I assume?
Yes. Fiddle off.
Yeah, it's like a rap battle with fiddles.
You got it.
All right.
Well,
yeah, I'm down.
We'll have to dress the part, too. So that's where everyone wanted to go. And so the folks that were sort of making decisions for us at that time said, let's talk about this. Let's talk about the future of our location, this village. But let's do it at the bar. So they all meet the Saugnash Tavern, have a conversation, and they have an official vote.
Where was it? Where was Saugnash Tavern?
It was on Wacker and Lake.
Okay.
So now there's this big shiny glass building there, but
there
is
where we are right now.
Yeah, but there is a commemorative plaque
okay.
right in front that talks about the Saugnash Tavern.
All
right. Simple, sort of like if you think of like you know the log cabin where Abraham Lincoln grew up. That's what it looked like,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So they went and met there, had some drinks, you know, ales, whiskey, cider, and voted and said, should we make Chicago a town? And so they said, majority won. They said yes. And so Chicago is born at the Saugnash Tavern as a township, but then they go back in 1837 and do the same thing again and becomes an official city. So I always say that Chicago was born in a bar not once, but twice.
Very
you know?
Cool.
So yeah, that awesome. That really kind of sets that's the tone awesome. For our future,
the
I think.
The country was yeah. born in a bar, right? I mean, wasn't the revolution planned in a bar?
Yeah, the Green Dragon Tavern in Boston.
That's it.
That's
yeah,
where
yeah.
all of the drunkards, patriots,
yep. well.
They'd go there and hang out and get really kind of shitty on
drunk, right?
shitty on rum
yeah.
and cider. And they basically planned a hell of a lot of events, but really the most
tired of paying tax.
Yeah, the most important one's the Boston Tea Party.
Out,
yeah.
We can take them out, no problem.
Yeah. Well, they went
like Indians and dump some tea.
Yeah. So the thing was they were pissed
don't
about
don't tell me those guys weren't hammered.
Always.
Always.
they originally went to the Green Dragon and they were pissed about the taxation on rum, right? Because they were drinking it.
Right.
So then they planned this whole Boston Tea Party thing, but they're like, we're not going to dump the rum.
Yeah, right.
So what's the next best thing?
Smart.
Tea.
Yeah.
Right? So actually, right before that happened, the night of, they went to the Green Dragon, drank to get, you know, courage,
yeah,
liquid courage,
yeah.
and then go, you know. And I always say, yeah, you know, by the way, Paul Revere, he was riding from bar to bar.
Well, yeah, you know, gotta fuel up.
Yeah. So, yes, we're definitely, our country was born on alcohol.
Pint, please. Oh, and by the way, the British are coming.
Yeah. Hey guys, you might want to wrap this up. You know, maybe slam this.
I'm gonna chug this real quick,
right.
And then continue on with the message.
Oh, that's it. Those are great stories. Thank you. That's great.
It's awesome. Well, because this is a working bar and we have a private event up here. I can't tell you how fun this was, Liz.
Yeah.
I could talk forever.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
With you, and often do late at the Old Time Ale House.
Yes.
I
will more than likely be there this evening.
Yeah.
Catching the Nats Dodgers game.
Oh yeah.
Oh, see who you got to play.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Who
doesn't
do you
matter?
Do you
this Cub train can't be slowed down. It
yeah.
can't be slowed down.
I'm rooting for the Nationals.
Okay.
It's a shorter flights.
Uh-huh.
And also, we actually have a better record with them this year.
Gotcha.
So.
A couple final maybe free plugs. So History on Tap.
Yep.
Com. And Brewseum.
Yeah, ChicagoBrewseum.org.
So definitely check out both of those. And you're going to be, I know you do tours locally. Yeah. And then you'll probably, I'm hoping, have like some more international or national tours as well.
Yep. I have a couple of November tours happening, probably something happening in December. I'll be announcing a national weekend in a U.S. city soon in early 2017.
Sweet. Awesome.
And then definitely another international trip happening in 2017.
Cool.
Awesome. Yeah. To our listeners, a tour with Liz is a fantastic experience. Yeah. I mean, you will learn, you will have fun, you will probably have a couple beers. And
maybe,
and you know, I can't say enough about it. When you used to come into Patty Long's, that was fantastic. So, I got nothing. I'm not plugging anything this week. What about you, Bruce? What do you got going on with the tour?
You know, just a little, just throwing this out there. I've been working on this beer tasting class, so mainly educational, mainly entertainment, but educational as well. So it's going to be probably about an hour and a half. Going to taste a bunch of different beers, but we're going to talk a little bit more than we normally would about them and really kind of go into depth. Maybe pair some food with them as well. So I'm not sure on the details of that, but that's coming down the pike at some point. Only been 4 years in progress.
Greatness takes time, Bruce.
Yeah, Don't rush it.
That's right. So keep your eyes peeled.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, thank you to anyone still listening, and we appreciate it. And we will be back with another podcast very soon.
Thanks, everyone.
To the day.